This is the You Can Learn Chinese podcast, part of the Seneca Network from SUP China. For everyone who's trying to learn Chinese or reaching for the next level, you came to the right place. I am your host, Jared Turner, longtime resident of China, co-founder of the Mandarin Companion Graded Reader series, and since I bought a solar-powered treadmill, I've been walking on sunshine. My co-host is John Pasden, co-founder of Mandarin Companion, founder of All Set Learning, the Chinese Grammar Wiki, Sinosplice.com, and words cannot express how much he hates emojis. Will Chinese one day unseat English to become the dominant language around the world? We are going to discuss a paper by Professor Jeffrey Gill who predicts that one day it will. Guest interview is with Amani Kaur with a philosophical perspective on how Chinese shapes our view of humanity. All this and more, let's get to it. Hey guys, this is Jared Turner coming at you from Utah in the United States.
Hey guys, my name is John Pasden. I am in Shanghai, China. How's it going, everybody?
Okay, JP, before we kick into today's topic, I'm just going to mention a bit of the source of this topic. We have an email from one of our listeners, a very avid listener. Her name is Ann Giles, and I believe she's working with you right now. Is that right, John?
Yeah, she's a client at All Set Learning, very serious student.
Well, the great thing about Ann is she's written us a few emails. She is 62, and she's very passionate right now about learning Chinese. And she's really I think encouraged by people, their stories in learning Chinese. And she also cited a number of challenges there are for people who are over 50, who are learning Chinese. And so it was really inspiring, I think, to see some of the things that she's writing and see how dedicated that she is to learning Chinese. And it's just one of those testaments that it really doesn't matter how old you are. It's really about the effort that you're putting in to learning the language. So I'll give a shout out to Anne, and I'm going to let John introduce this topic.
Yeah, and if you are in the same boat, if you are in your 60s, 70s, 80s, and you're learning Chinese and you're having success, we'd love to hear from you. Because Anne was asking us to do a little bit more on this topic, and we'd like to, but I think we need some more information. And it would be great to talk to more older learners about their challenges and especially their successes. So we'd love to hear from you. Okay, but for today's podcast, we actually want to talk about something that Anne brought to our attention. It is an interesting topic. It's one that's been going around for years, actually. She cited a specific paper by Jeffrey Gill called "Will a Character-Based Writing System Stop Chinese Becoming a Global Language? A Review and Reconsideration of the Debate." So, I think we're all pretty familiar with this idea, with China on the rise as a global superpower, with its economy being this nigh unstoppable juggernaut. Will Chinese become this world language that could even replace English?
No, that's a fantastic question. And there's definitely a number of viewpoints on this subject.
Okay, so Dr. Jeffrey Gill is from Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia. And one of the issues that he rightly points out is the whole writing system of Chinese. If Chinese is going to be truly global, then that means it needs to be a spoken language and a written language, right? And Chinese has this whole thing with characters, which you might consider a bit of a roadblock to the rest of the world adopting the writing system. Okay, so Dr. Gill writes, "Most academics and media commentators argue that Chinese's character-based writing system will prevent, the rise to a global language because it is difficult and time-consuming to learn." So his first point as a counter-argument is that this view is based on the flawed assumption that all learners of Chinese must learn to read and write and must do so to a native-like level. And he's saying that that hasn't been the case with English. It doesn't need to be the case with Chinese. Mm-hmm. And I think he does have a point here, because one of the things that we often forget is everything changes. The Chinese 100 years from now is not going to be the Chinese that we know today. And if Chinese does become more and more global, then the rest of the world is going to be influencing the evolution of the language. And we don't really know where that's going to go. But one thing that I can say is right now, we don't see a whole lot of Chinese being used globally and foreigners really actively contributing to the evolution of the language. Sure, maybe a little bit, but I just don't see much of that right now.
you know, a little more on his point. I think that, you know, this is a very valid thing, is that essentially you don't need to be native level in English in order to use it. And it's still a global language, right? Well, the same thing in Chinese, right? I mean, John, I say this before, your Chinese is far beyond mine. If there's anyone that I know has, you know, near native level Chinese, it's definitely John. But John, I'm sure you wouldn't even classify yourself that way. Or would you? Maybe you would.
No. I'm not. I'm not fancy pantsy enough with my Chinese. I'm just pretty good, you know.
Gotcha. Well, you know, mine isn't. But I still am able to function in China. I ran a business in China, go to government offices and stuff. And I wouldn't say like I'm super fluent, you know, the F word, fluent, right, in Chinese. Proficient in areas, absolutely. But even before I got to level, I was still functional, be able to do a whole lot of things. So you don't have to be native level to be able to use Chinese and be conversational and get things done. So he does have a valid point in this respect.
Yeah, but again, reading and writing. So he's saying you don't need to read and write at a native-like level.
That's true. And that goes on to his second point. And I'll read this here. He says, he argues that this view ignores the uses of devices like computers and mobile phones which convert pinyin into characters, meaning learners need only to learn pinyin and character recognition. And so that's a very good point because, you know, we talk about this all the time on the podcast. You don't need to learn to handwrite characters in order to be fluent in the language.
Right. And it's true. Pinyin will get you pretty far in character recognition, although that's still a significant amount of work, like above and beyond what a lot of other languages require. You know, language, you know, English, no characters, just some letters. Bit more accessible. Okay, but thirdly, he says that there is a historical precedent for the adoption of characters outside of China in the form of the longstanding use of written Chinese for scholarly and official purposes in Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. All right, that's true. We're getting into some serious history here. Although, if you're going to talk about Vietnam, isn't it significant that Vietnam kind of like stopped using Chinese characters for their society, and Korea like barely uses them, right? I mean, like, if anything, Japan is really the champion of Chinese characters. They took the characters, they like modified them, they used characters to create their own phonetic writing system. They even created their own characters that don't exist in China. Like, Japan is pretty diehard characters, but Japan is also not your typical country.
And I'm really curious to know, John, because I'd really know some of the background on like the Korean, because Korean has a different system of writing and it is phonetic based. But was that more of a modern concept or has that been long time developed?
Yeah, so East Asia, those cultures didn't have their own writing systems before they came into contact with China. So then they realized writing systems are pretty cool. So they adopted Chinese for their records. And then over time, they decided to do it differently. So the phonetic writing system in Korea is called Hangul. And it dates all the way back to, I had to look this up, but I can tell you, 1443.
Wow. Okay, that's actually quite interesting. All right, and then the fourth point he makes is that he argues that the view that maybe Chinese won't become a global language is based excessively on linguistic properties, okay? And but then he goes on to cite that, hey, English has a lot of inconsistencies and irregularities, and it shows how, and he uses that as an example to say, hey, look, linguistic properties, or maybe, I think in parlance, maybe like the difficulty of the language, it doesn't necessarily determine whether a language becomes global. And so he concludes that a character-based writing system will not, in and of itself, prevent Chinese from attaining global language status. Okay, so John, we kind of run these four points here. I'll just review it real quick. First, he cites that you don't need to be native level in a language in order to be able to use it and actually communicate. Second, that you don't actually need to learn to handwrite characters. Pinyin and character recognition is enough in order to have a capable command of the written language. Third, that there's a historical precedence of Chinese being used in other countries. And then fourth, that just because it's difficult and has irregularities, it doesn't exclude it from being a global language. So, all right, John, let's go ahead and break this down and talk about the different points of this.
All right. Well, I think there are a few important points here that haven't really been mentioned in this article. You know, if you wanted to refute some of those points, one is just that, you know, what happened historically with different writing systems in Asia since those countries adopted Chinese characters. But I think what's more important is to look at, you know, the full picture. we've got a world which has been global for not really that long, but in the time that it's been becoming, you know, this global marketplace, English has been the language that these different countries use to communicate. And there have been considerable investments into, you know, education and all kinds of things for getting whole countries' population speaking English. And when you invest that much for so long into your entire society, you don't just swap it out overnight because something new comes along, you know?
Yeah, that's something I think right away that there's generational shifts. And I think let's even look on the English side of things. Like you bring a good point, John, about how there's so many institutions built around English. I mean, if you look at simply something like air traffic control, if you're going to be a pilot, you have to speak English.
Right.
Because all air traffic control all over the world is in English. Okay. So, I mean, there's like a structural institutional standard like that. And so there's a significant investment in at least in that industry. And there's going to be a lot of other examples like that too. One thing I think of, John, is that I'm thinking about like cliche American Hollywood movies of maybe like World War II era. And, you know, if there's going to be like a villain around that time, you know, he's going to have like a Russian accent or he's going to have like this thick German accent or something. And you know, they play to that stereotype. But, you know, nowadays, you know, you meet someone from Europe and typically they're going to speak English like at a near native level, or they'll have very little accent, if any, from their native language. And I think that's really fascinating because you look at how the impact of English education has already made on global citizenry, and it's been very significant.
Yeah, not to mention in Asia, right? Like, meet so many like Korean, Japanese, Chinese, you know, Thai people that just speak really fluent English now, and some of them haven't even left their own countries. It's really impressive. But I like the fact that you brought up, like pop culture, because that's a factor too. Like the United States and other countries have been exporting their media, you know, in the form of movies and TV shows and songs for years. And the world has kind of eaten it up. And so far, English has been the main language there. And it's not that China isn't trying. I mean, they do have some, you know, pop music and movies that are going out to the rest of the world. And it's just not quite resonating yet. And I think that's going to take time because China just needs more time to interact with the rest of the world and kind of strike a balance for, you know, appreciating each other and all that kind of thing. But it's just one more aspect of the puzzle. It takes time, right?
Yeah. You know, there's something interesting. I'll give a little insight into Chinese media. I actually had the opportunity, it was about 5 or 6 years ago, to work on an international joint venture between Shanghai Media Group and another U.S. media based company. And through that project, I got to learn a little bit about, like, Shanghai Media Group. They're like the second largest broadcaster in China. Yeah, I mean, they have double-digit TV stations, radio stations, newspapers, all this type of stuff. So they're like Time Warner in America. They're huge. And they have engaged in a very significant project of dubbing pretty much all of their sitcoms and many of their shows into other foreign languages, like, well, obviously English being one, but also other target languages of places where they're trying to get these TV shows and their media out to. So, you know, I think that's one aspect, but it's a little bit of a top down of like trying to push it out as opposed to a demand. You know, when Hollywood releases a blockbuster movie, it's usually demanded by many markets, if you will, internationally. If China produces a hit movie, it still is not getting a lot of fanfare outside of China.
Right. Some, but it's not the Hollywood level.
And that really comes down to distribution.
This is actually a problem that I sometimes encounter with my clients. And they ask me, like, I want to watch some Chinese movies or TV shows. Can you recommend some good ones? And it's a little easier with movies because, you know, there are many years of movies and they're definitely good ones. But with TV shows, man, it's always kind of hard. It's not that there are no good ones. It's just like there's not like this big long list that jumps to mind. And I'm okay with watching Chinese TV. I will watch it. It's just I just don't feel like it has that really strong global appeal yet.
You know, honestly, John, I think this I may be addressing a little bit of the elephant in the room. I think that this has a little bit to do with the censorship nature of China. And if anyone really delving into this and being familiar with kind of this, how media is done in China, obviously the government regulates and censors all the stuff. And in my interactions with Shanghai Media Group, we had a discussion with one of the executives about this. And pretty much what happens is there's self-censorship. And so let's think about if you're brainstorming an idea.
Right.
You just want to brainstorm, right? And you don't want to have to like limit your ideas. And then later on you sort it out. But what kind of happens on the China side, if like, you got a show writer or script ideas like this, and they say, hey, let's do this law show about this court drama. And it's going to be about corrupt government officials are getting taken down. And it's like, oh, wait a second. That could be sensitive. Or you even delve anything into legal, all of a sudden, oh, wait, that's sensitive, right? Because you're going to get, so the Chinese government actually doesn't censor a lot of these shows these days because stuff that might be even controversial never gets produced because they're just like, we won't even take the risk of like going down the road and then getting axed after we're all done. And so one thing is that actually limits a lot of that creativity and you have a, imagine all of those blockbuster movies that could have been made had they not been self-censored.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about this is that it's not like courage. It's not like, oh, they don't have the courage to produce this stuff and hope that maybe it'll pass the censors.
Nope.
It's economics.
Yep.
Like, it's expensive to produce something and then have it rejected and have to redo it. And a company can't afford to just keep redoing something on the hopes that it'll pass the censors.
Yep, totally. Exactly. And I think this underscores one of the things about China, okay, is especially there is a, it's a very, to a degree, even considering how large the market is, how many people there are in that country, there is still a significant amount of insularity of the culture and of the media. And that's due to things like the Great Firewall, right? So it limits the amount of the stuff that actually gets to come into China. And to a degree, because China has developed a lot of their own networks, their social platforms and stuff, but they're only used in China and they're not really used globally. So that also inhibits some of these cultural spread of these Chinese elements that may appeal to other people and invite them or give them that desire to go ahead and learn Chinese.
Yeah, that's true. If there was free, internet traffic between China and other countries, you'd get a lot more interactions and more opportunities to spread Chinese culture and Chinese language. But right now there's a lot of barriers there.
Yeah. So I think this is just an overarching aspect of, I think, just really can prevent Chinese from being that global language.
Let's look at a few other questions because this paper doesn't mention the only issues that there are. And, I did a little bit of research and there's some really great points out there. Like, one way to look at this problem is just numbers. And it's pretty well known that India's population is growing faster than China's. And, India pretty strong on English. So you have so many countries all over the world that already have English as their second language. You have quite a few countries that speak English as their native language or an official language. But for Chinese, it's mostly just China. And so even the numbers, there are a lot of Chinese people, but even the numbers, when you look at the full picture globally, they're not really in China's favor.
Yeah, that's a great point, John. Even India. I think what's really interesting about India is that a lot of people might think that, Hindi is the number one language in India. But no, I think the last statistics I saw is that only 14% of India speaks Hindi. And that is the number one language outside of English. So English is that language that unifies the country, all the media is in. And funny enough, still not everyone speaks English in India.
Actually, as China's population starts to shrink, which is projected to happen this century, and India's population continues to grow, the number of native Hindi speakers probably will surpass the number of native Mandarin speakers.
Well, that'd be interesting. Considering we don't have a reversal on the demographic shift in China, because they did stop the One China policy, but we'll see, right?
But now they have this whole first world, we don't want to have too many kids because they're expensive, that whole thing going on, right?
Yeah. It's more of a cultural phenomenon now as opposed to government regulated.
Well, economic too, cultural and economic. But then there's another issue that I think is really interesting, which is one of technology. So, when English rose to its position as the global language of communication, we were at a certain place in technological development. That was like when, radio was first coming about, then came TV and all that. But now we're getting to this point where, machine translation works really well. Even real-time speaking into a translator and having it spit out the other language is starting to work better and better. So it really makes you wonder, is that going to hinder some new, you know, more foreign language from becoming more popular when people have these tools at their disposal?
You know, John, I actually have a meme about that. it's one. It's from the animated version of Heidi, and I think Heidi is pushing someone in a wheelchair. This girl, and she's like, and Heidi's like, "Oh, I'm learning Chinese." And this girl in the wheelchair, and the girl in the wheelchair says, "Oh, you don't need to do that. There's an app that translates for you." And then Heidi pushes her out of the wheelchair off a cliff. So anyway. So, I mean, yeah.
Good old Heidi.
So some of these things are getting better, right, for us. But you know, it's not going to take that place of really learning the language. So,
yeah, just the need for this global language for, you know, countries to do business with other countries, it's just kind of lessening. And if English is already in place when it's needed, it really raises the question, like, is it really necessary? And you know, as someone who really wants the rest of the world to learn Chinese, because I think it's a great language, it's very fun, it's unique, I hope that doesn't mean in the future people are going to use apps for everything and not learn languages. But in terms of just everyone learning Chinese, I don't know. I'm skeptical.
Yeah. And now to hit on one of Professor Gill's other points, he talks about, hey, there's a historical precedence of this, of Korea, Japan, and Vietnam adopting Chinese for scholarly official purposes. Well, you know, John, you bring up a really good point that historically, yeah, they didn't have their own writing system at the time, or maybe it was rather loose. And Chinese came with this very well-structured thing. Well, essentially, I look at that as maybe in political terms, the middle terms, a power vacuum, right? There's nothing in place there, so it filled a void. But we see what happened since then, that essentially they've abandoned Chinese characters or modified and developed their own thing that was, you know, even easier. And John, you're the Japanese major, but in Japanese, there are kana, which have phonetic pronunciations. Is that correct?
Right, kana are phonetic.
Okay, so you have this combination of kanji and kana, right, which is, you know, some phonetic and non-phonetic, right? And that underscores one of the challenges that we always talk about on this podcast is that you come across a character that you don't know, well, you can't decode it. You can't just pronounce it if you don't know it already. Now, I know there's those arguments to say, oh, well, you might know some of the phonetic elements and that maybe you can guess the pronunciation. But once again, guess, right? You can't be certain about it. Whereas English or other alphabet-based languages, you don't come across a word you don't know, but at least you can pronounce it.
Yeah, and of course, the more you know, the easier it is to guess. But when we're talking about Chinese becoming a global language, you know, everyone's starting at zero or close to it. So yeah, it's rough.
And then his last point is saying, hey, there's inconsistencies and irregularities in English. Well, I don't know. That kind of argument falls flat with me, John, because there are also inconsistencies and irregularities in Chinese. Every language has it, right?
No. Say it ain't so.
Why is it mayo instead of buyo, right?
Right. So Jared, if you were to make a metaphor, you know, some kind of comparison of like, you know, two competing things, what would it be? My idea is like, think of the PC and the Mac computer. So the PC had total dominance for so long. And then the Mac came along, and it was kind of different, and it was special, and a lot of people really liked it. And so they were very enthusiastic about it, and now Mac is sitting there with a nice little share of the market. But the PC market has not gone away. It is very strong, and it's probably going to stay strong for quite a while. So it's kind of weird to say China is the Mac of the languages, but I feel like this is what we might see play out.
You know, what I think maybe an analogy I might use is maybe even audio. So we have MP3s, and then there's uncompressed WAV files. And frankly, a WAV file is 10 times the size of a MP3, but it's, you know, better audio quality, you know, or something. So maybe you could say that. It's lossless. There you go. So in Chinese, you know.
Is lossless.
It's lossless, but it's like an uncompressed wave. You know, it takes takes way more size, way more storage in order to actually play that and listen to it.
Interesting comparison.
I don't know. Maybe it's made up. There's all sorts of flaws in that. Don't pay attention. Just stay on the surface there. So John, then, if you don't think that Chinese is going to become the next global language, what do you see as the future of Chinese?
I just see Chinese growing a bit as a global language and then just having a nice little comfortable position as number two. But I think English will be on top for quite a while.
I'd have to agree with that. But, you know, I still believe that, as I think as you do too, that Chinese will grow in importance. And if one thing, guys, if anyone's been listening to this podcast, especially the interviews for any period of time, there's an underlying theme that I come across again as I interview people is that Chinese helps you make connections that you wouldn't have otherwise. Even if you have a translator, whether it's an actual person translator or a machine translator, software translator, that's great. It helps you facilitate communication. But there's all these other things you can't quantify when you speak the language, like actual like feelings, you know, the connection, respect, understanding, things like that that happen when you take that time to learn language. And so I still think that Chinese is going to be extremely valuable because China is growing as an importance on the global stage and more business is going to continue to be done with China globally. And so the language is going to be grow in importance, frankly, as the time goes on.
All right, so up next we have a word from our sponsor.
And today our sponsor is
All Set Learning.
Woohoo!
All Set Learning is my company that does personalized Chinese learning, and we have some courses which are specifically focused on Mandarin Companions books.
Yay! You know, I don't work with any of these people, but I have heard some people who've done them, and they absolutely love them.
Yeah, so the idea is you've read the book. It helps your reading comprehension, obviously, your vocabulary. It might even help your speaking. But to really help your speaking, you're going to need to speak more. So if you like the book and now you want to talk to a teacher about it, maybe ask questions, maybe discuss your feelings about the plot or, you know, characters, whatever, this gives you a great chance to practice entirely in Chinese.
And just a note on that, John, this is something that I've worked with teachers to do in classrooms with students, is that, you know, hey, take the textbook out and put a graded reader instead. And everyone reads and then comes to class and discusses and have different activities based on it. And it's really successful. A lot of teachers have done very well with this in the classroom. And so this is exciting because it's very personalized. It's something specific for you. Great opportunities for discussion, something you can get really engaged about, and it's super cool.
Yeah, you might be surprised by how much more you have to say about a story rather than a textbook. All right, so those are called the All Set Learning Book Club courses, and we'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay, now it's time for rants and raves. John, what do you got for us today? You got a rant or do you have a rave?
I've got kind of a weird rave. Okay, so Jared, you remember 2 weeks ago how we talked about Chinese names and how that helps your learning?
Yep.
Well, my rave is about like Chinese movie credits because I like to watch the credits now. Yeah, listen to this. I like to watch the credits now for movies or TV shows because I scan them to see like, well, one, for like the advanced learner in me, are there any surnames that I haven't come across? But two, are there any names that are so easy that they could be the name of a character in a Mandarin Companion, you know, breakthrough or level one or level two book?
Okay, I'll give it to you.
Because there really are. Yeah, I remember there's this star named Chen Hao. Like her given name is Hao, like Ni Hao, the Hao. Wow. And it's just like, they're so simple, some of these names. And there are so many. So if you're a learner, this might sound weird, but you might actually get a little bit of satisfaction out of like reading names and credits because there are a lot of easy ones and you might be surprised what can be a name.
Well, that's pretty cool, John. I guess I shall pay attention now.
There you go. Okay, what do you got, Jared? Rant or rave?
Okay, I have a rave today. This rave actually comes from one of our former guests, Linda Yi of Panda Cub Stories. So she sent me a message on Instagram and she told me about this book. It's super cool. I got to preface, I haven't read this book, but it's called These Violent Delights by Chloe Gong. And it is an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet into Shanghai 1926. And so it looks like a pretty cool plot. It has a lot of reviews. It has like 13,000 reviews on Goodreads. And it talks about how Juliet Tsai, she's a former flapper, 1920s flapper dancer, and she returned to assume her role as a proud heir of a Scarlet Gang. It's a network of criminals, and then she falls in love with this Roma Mantegov, Juliet's first love, and betrayal. And anyway, and it has like monsters in it, and it looks like pretty funny. It's actually
monsters.
Yes. It has like a somewhat of a, I think a, it's a bit gory in some respects, but it's really interesting to read the author. Her view on this is a bit of her love story to Shanghai. I guess she's American-born Chinese, I believe. And so it looks
with
like
monsters.
Kind of fun. With monsters. So it's a little bit of a reverse inverse of what we do, right? So like, for example, we take Sherlock Holmes. We adapted Sherlock Holmes to 1920s, 30s Shanghai in Chinese and simplified it. She took Romeo and Juliet, adapted it to 1920s Shanghai, but it's written in English. So it's kind of like if you want to find the inverse of one of our books, this would be a fun one to check out. It's called These Violent Delights by Klo Gong.
And it has monsters. I'm curious if these are Chinese monsters or Western monsters.
Well, you know what? Maybe, John, maybe you should read it. I hear it's pretty violent.
Yeah, maybe. All right. In the meantime, I think we have an interview.
My name is Amani. My Chinese name is Ke Yiming. Always like to add that, as that was given to me from my first Chinese teacher. I was in education for about 2-3 years, teaching Chinese at a private boarding school in Massachusetts. And now I'm working in DC at the Albright Stonebridge Group.
That's Amani Kaur. Some years ago, he reached out to John and ended up doing an internship with All Set Learning. Amani's story illustrates how seemingly small experiences can have such a significant impact on our life and shape our motivations and life decisions. Stay with us. Amani, why did you start learning Chinese?
I was in middle school and there was a language requirement for everyone to take a language. I took Spanish actually at the beginning, and in that course, I found that certain students had new names in Spanish, but I didn't get one. Mine was still Amani, but across the hall, there were people who were taking Chinese, and this was the second year in the Chinese program at my school, and I just really wanted a new name. I heard that Chinese was difficult. I heard that there were tones and things like that, things that really had no idea about their characters, and I decided to take it the next year. And I started taking it and, you know, continue learning ever since.
That's kind of interesting. So you said a lot of your other classmates in Spanish, they didn't get a new name. What do you think was really attractive about that?
It was me just honestly wanting to stand out. You got to think about me as a seventh grader. People have these new things that I didn't have. I was like, okay, well, maybe if I had one too, it'd be really interesting. So I was in class for 3 weeks and then I got that name and there was a sense of pride to it. So just hearing that other students had this experience, it definitely influenced me to want to learn Chinese.
But I imagine there was maybe a little more than the aspect of having a new name that really attracted you to Chinese. So maybe you could talk about that.
Yeah. So the name was just the starting point. Then I started talking with other students to see what Chinese class was also like. You hear people talking about it being difficult. You hear people talking about the tones, how there are 4 tones, maybe even a 5th tone if you count the no tone. And it was basically just a foreign concept to me, based on where I was and my language learning experience in Spanish. And I really just want to give it a shot. And then I think at that time too, there was this idea that Chinese was extremely difficult, but can help you find jobs in the future. I wasn't naturally thinking of my job in middle school, but those are things that you just tell your parents.
Who does?
Those are things you just tell your parents like, oh yeah, you know, maybe it can help me in the future. But really it was just fun.
But what kept you into Chinese? Why did you continue to study Chinese?
When I was actually in the class, I started to see like an artistic aspect of the actual Chinese characters. I was really drawn to the idea of stroke order and that being something you really need to focus on to actually show that you understand what these characters mean. You have radicals and all those things kept me with it. And I really just needed to perfect my tones. I mean, in my first year, second year, third year of Chinese, my tones were all over the place. But I think what actually kept me going outside of the language requirement and the general interest was I was able to go to China in my 9th grade year with my school for free. Went to Taiwan for 4 days, Beijing for 4 days, and Xi'an for 4 days. And that really just opened my eyes. I mean, I was studying Chinese for so long and did not dare say anything in Chinese when I was actually in places where I could use my Chinese language. And there was actually a instance when my teacher wanted me to order like an egg. And I told her like, no, I can't do it. I can't. And she kept on pushing me to do it. And in the end, I did not do it. And she did it for me. But later during that trip, I was actually need to use the bathroom and couldn't find a bathroom. So I went to a restaurant and the person in the restaurant gave me a menu. And I was like, oh no, sorry. I don't want to eat. And he kept giving me a menu because he didn't understand English. I didn't trust my Chinese. But the one thing I learned in Chinese class that I felt really confident in terms of my tones, because I was really self-conscious, was saying, can I use the bathroom? Because in my Chinese classroom, I had to ask that in Chinese. So I asked him like, 我可以去厕所吗? Just like that. And he showed me to the bathroom. I was like, oh, so this is why I'm learning Chinese. I can actually use this in a place that speaks Chinese.
Wow. That's a great breakthrough moment. I mean, it's like kind of the little bird that's in the nest and the mom pushes him out the nest and you got to fly, right?
Yeah, it was crazy. I did not expect it. I was so very proud of myself.
You said you were to Taiwan, then Beijing. So this was halfway through your trip. You finally used your Chinese in a Chinese-speaking country. Wow. Yeah. What was your experience like after that?
I think the biggest thing was just when I went back to the classroom, I understood why I was learning the language. And it really just increased my passion for it. And it's hard because I think that when I continued to study throughout high school, I still was dedicated to Chinese in the exact same way. But I felt like I couldn't get there in the classroom. And I always knew like, okay, I got to go back. And I need to find a way if I really want to become good at Chinese. I think that's the biggest change.
So you went on this trip. It was very influential on you. But, you know, you decide, hey, I'm going to continue to study this. What happened after that?
Yeah. So after that, it was just about how to get back because I feel like I wasn't where I wanted to be in my Chinese language. And I considered some study abroad programs, but the biggest thing for me about not being able to go to abroad at the time was it influencing my athletic career since I played football, wrestling, and lacrosse. And I didn't really want to miss any of those seasons. But towards the end of graduating my senior year of high school, my Chinese teacher, she helped me find a application to go to study in China for a year. So after graduating high school, I took a gap year. I was actually more excited for my gap year than I was to actually go to college in the U.S. And I applied for two programs and one I was waitlisted for, but then I got the other program. And I was just really excited to actually go in an affordable way to China. At that time, I went to Beijing. So I was at Beishida, Beijing Normal University. And I was doing it. I was taking Chinese. I think it was 20 hours of Chinese a week for one academic year. I was in a classroom of other international students, so not just Americans. And that was really what changed my whole language learning experience because I was getting a syllabus in Chinese. I was doing everything in China in Chinese. And, you know, there were some embarrassing moments in the beginning. I remember when I took a placement test, I was so nervous that my interviewer asked me like, 你是哪国人? And I was like, huh? I was like, what country is na? It was like, am I 哪国人? And she was like, oh yeah. So she's trying to ask me basically where I'm from. And I was just like, yes.
Yeah. So, 你是哪国人?
I was like, yeah.
But I'd like to be interested to hear from this. You told me about your first experience going to China, Asia, if you will. Yeah. And then now you're coming back. How was the second experience different compared to your first experience?
Yeah, I think that's a huge topic because something I did not talk about just a moment ago was when I went to Asia, to China. So I went to Taiwan first, which obviously has different geopolitical differences with China and Hong Kong and Macau. But when I was in Taiwan, I went there first and then to Beijing and then Xi'an. In Taiwan, the biggest thing was race was a factor because I found that in Taiwan, no one was really staring at me in the way they were in Beijing. No one was staring at me in the way they were in Xi'an. No one was asking for photos or holding babies, which my friend also got asked to do that. So there was a difference in my expectation going back.
So I, for our listeners here, because you can't see our Amani, Amani's black. So your experience, your yes. highlight was, it was different, right?
Yes, yes. So basically, when I went to Taiwan, it felt really different for me. And then I went to Beijing, Xi'an. But this time I was going to Beijing, China instead of Taiwan. And going back to Beijing, I just had expectation that maybe I could stick out a little bit from being a different skin tone. And that just grounded myself in terms of maybe what to expect when I'm in the subway or maybe in public settings or talking to people in China when I'm not in the larger cities. That's just from like an identity perspective. And the other side, from the perspective of language learning, I knew exactly what I need to do in the classroom in order to be where I wanted to be in my Chinese language moving forward. So I was able to actually apply myself and study the best I could, but also learn how to get out. And, you know, maybe that's playing basketball. Maybe that's joining a Taekwondo club. There are a lot of things to do in China with clubs on college campuses, even like a dance club. But yeah, I definitely was able to apply myself better, but also have better expectations on what it would be like as a black person in China.
Okay, well, this is something I'd like to hear from your perspective. I think it's one thing is if anyone listening to this, they've been to China, if you're non-Chinese, non-Asian, typically people are going to look at you. So I'm used to that, you know, especially I've gone to small towns and stuff. I have white skin. They stare at you. I have people with blonde hair. There's even more, right? But I know it's also the kind of the they're going to stare at you too, Amani, because you're black. But what do you think is maybe some differences that you have perceived or experienced because you were black in China?
I think the biggest thing is just a lot of attention. And basically, what do you do with that? And
the attention, that also, what do you mean by that?
Because I think it can be off-putting sometimes. And I think that you can have a conversation with people and there can be the balance between what's curiosity and what's ignorance. I guess an example of that is, I remember when I went to Kugong, so Imperial Palace in Beijing, I had someone ask me in 2013, I think, if I was Obama's son. And
I've had a black friend and everyone would always say, you know, give him a thumbs up and say, Obama, because he was black,
Yeah, I thought it was funny. There's no malintent with it. And so we just started talking after that and nothing really big about it. I know when I played basketball, because I played basketball in high school, just playing pickup. It's a great way to meet people and learn new words. And some people somehow talk to me about Kobe Bryant. You know, I think there are a lot of cultural avenues to speaking with people as a black person. And I think that it's more about that attention side. And I think it depends on whether you want to perceive it as positive or negative. And it really depends on, I think, your background, you know, your skin tone too sometimes. Because I know that sometimes it can be a little more difficult the darker you are, because I think there are different perceptions of Africans in China. Because as soon as people find out I'm American, the whole conversation changes.
Really?
Which I find really fascinating. So in my experience, I found it to be an opportunity to talk with people, an opportunity to maybe dispel some myths, but really just to connect and engage with people. Because once you go into race in China, I think it's a really difficult topic, because I think the American conception of race, the American history of race is different than that in China, and maybe even, you know, Western concept of race. But I just try to find a way to allow myself to talk with people and see who they are as a person and allow for a deeper connection.
Now, I think that's fantastic. So it sounds to me you're using that as an opportunity to connect with people. So you went and did this study abroad and you were there for a year. What were you doing after that?
So after that, I went to Middlebury College and I was going to college. The only thing I knew I wanted to do was study Chinese and do some art classes on the side as well. So I was basically just taking Chinese language courses and trying to find a way to actually use what I learned in the country. And I graduated in 2018 with a major in Chinese and philosophy, also able to do some TAing during my senior year for intermediate level drill section, which is really interesting because I was rugby captain during my senior year at Middlebury. So I was actually teaching some of the athletes on the rugby team in that Chinese class. But yeah, definitely just trying to find ways to learn more about history and philosophy in China and continue studying and basically just find a way back.
So now you studied Chinese in middle school. You went to a Chinese university. It sounds like you went back, came back. You studied at university. Tell me about some of the differences that you found in the different educational programs and systems you were in. Maybe talk about those and what you thought was maybe worked better and things maybe that were a little less effective for you.
So in middle school, I think it was just for fun. It was a new thing to do. And I went abroad. I was like, okay, just for 12 days, but I was like, okay, this is what I'm studying. In high school, I was trying to get there as well. But it was also grade focused because I want to make sure I was performing well from an academic perspective. But even though I was doing well academically, I wasn't really learning as much as I wanted to, like functionally, like, you know, avoiding the fluent word, just functionally. And are you proficient? And then, you know, going back the third time, I guess going to study at Beijing Normal University, that was me just really diving head in into what the language learning experience would be. And I actually went back. I completely forgot to mention because going back and forth between China, Taiwan and everything, I went to Dalian during my summer of 2016. And that was an intensive language learning experience through the Critical Language Scholarship. It was a really intense program. I learned a lot from it. And that was when I was just trying to talk about anything new in China. So at that point in time, I was really confident in my language ability, but I wanted to talk about those foreign concepts, maybe things that aren't as prevalent in China's society. I know, for example, we had this forum about talking about relationships in China, and I decided to talk about relationships between people of different races, of different sexualities, of different genders. And it was one of the most difficult things I'd done at the time because
in Chinese.
And I remember I had this blank sheet of paper and I had my notes already on my phone. I went to my teacher like, oh, I want to talk about this. And she didn't really understand what that meant. And we just filled out that whole paper with words. Oh. And that was difficult because, you know, we're trying to talk about implicit bias, double standards, and talking about racism, but Western or American concept of racism and even cultural appropriation. And I remember talking about that with my classmates, and all my classmates would be nodding their heads because at this point, they're all American. They'd be like, oh, yeah, I know what he's saying. And my teacher would be like, okay. So even though she understood the word I was saying, the concept wasn't the same. That's definitely what I learned about language is that you can't say the correct word, but the actual meaning of it may not actually ring in the same way. The connotation could be different because you're talking about different historical societal factors. So at that time, I was just really trying to push myself in levels like, what can I talk about in Chinese that I want to talk about that I care about? Yeah. So I think that was really eye-opening for me too.
Wow. You know, I mean, that's a really important factor. I think, you know, some people don't get that. You know, it's just like, oh, well, I just need someone who can speak Chinese to translate, or, you know, I can just use Google Translate. Well, you miss those nuances, right? And these really important things. You know, yeah. I can share a quick story about that. My wife and I opened a cinnamon roll bakery in Shanghai. There is a direct translation for cinnamon roll in Chinese. It's rou gui zhuan, and it's really translated cinnamon roll. But you say that and nobody knows what it is because there's no cinnamon roll in Chinese. That's not a cultural thing. They have no idea what you mean by it. And so, yeah you can't just translate. You're trying to convey, there's all these perceptions and ideas and concepts behind it.
Yeah, exactly.
I imagine that was a real challenge because you're trying to introduce entirely new concepts in Chinese.
Yeah, but I think that's really the point of language learning. I mean, there's this idea, at least that my teacher told me in China, that things aren't going to be said in the most direct way in Chinese culture. You probably want to go in a circle and talk around it. I think that culturally fits with the idea in language where you use circumnavigation, where you may not know the exact word, but you need to explain the word so people understand what you're saying. So that's a fantastic task for any person learning a language to be able to do. I know I try to help my students do that all the time. It's like, oh, you don't know the word, but it's fine. You don't know the word. You can explain it. You know other words to explain this. So I think that's part of the language learning experience.
That's a really great story. And how many times did you have the opportunity to spend time in China?
I'm thinking of Taiwan, Beijing, and Xi'an. That was once went back to China specifically for my gap year and then through the Critical Language Scholarship in 2016. So 3 times total.
So at which stage do you feel like you made the most progress in your Chinese and why?
I think the second one was the most important because that's when I started reading books. And I just really wanted to learn the language in that way. For example, since I was studying Chinese for like 4 years at the time I took my gap year, I felt like my vocabulary was high, but I didn't actually know how to use the words properly. Or yeah. I didn't really know all the grammar. Like I didn't know how to use bei in a sentence or ba, like bei zi ju or ba zi ju. So I need to really go back to the basics. And because of that, I didn't find my coursework to be extremely challenging. I found it to be at a perfect level, but I want to supplement that with reading. So what I did, I was go to the bookstore and I went past all the college level books because this was on the actual campus. And I went to the books for kids, Like, they had fairy tales, classics, 1001 Arabian Nights. There's something about, like, Princess and the Pea, Pinocchio. And I was reading those books for kids. There was Pinyin, there was pictures, and there was even an introduction of, like, oh, in the story, we learn to listen to others, and, oh, we learn to try new things. And as I was learning through that, I kept reading and reading and reading, and I started to have an appreciation for fiction in Chinese, to where I don't like reading fiction in English. I actually find it not that interesting for some reason, but reading it in Chinese, there's like a beauty to it that I actually can't really explain, because as a non-native Chinese learner, there are things I can try to translate in my head or just say from hearing other Chinese people say it. But when I read it, I'm like, oh, that's exactly what I meant. That's exactly what I want to say. There are examples of how to say, understand someone on a deeper level. And the way they use level was like layer. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. Mm. Or there's something between us that, you know, will never be fixed. Like, there's something broken between us. And I'm like, oh, so it's not physically broken, but there's like a fissure. And those are things I'm learning from these books, not the kids' book at that time. But from reading those kids' books, I started to go to high school level. There's a book called Pingfan de Shijie, which is basically like Ordinary World. And I just, you know, read that when I could. And it was extremely dense. It probably took me like 45 minutes to read a page. But I just found it really interesting. I didn't realize at the time how much I was learning, because I just wanted to read, talk to people. And I think going to Beijing through that gap year, that's when I grew the most.
That's a cool story. And like, the impact of literacy can be huge, you know, for your proficiency. And this is actually good to do. A lot of people will do this. They'll go and like get kids' books. And I don't know if you, John and I, our kind of philosophy is a little more like, hey, stay away from the kids' books, because they're actually much harder than they seem. So
yes.
This would be good to kind of like, what would you recommend along this lines from your perspective? Would you go get the Chinese kids' books again, or would you kind of go at it a different way?
I think where I just wanted the challenge. And I was trying to explain to my classmates how hard this kids' book was, because It depends on what you want, because other books could be catered to you. Like, if you find a book for speakers of a different language trying to learn Chinese, they'll know what you need to know how to say. They'll know what you're run into in questions. But in these other kids' books, you'll learn random words, you know, the verb to pluck, you know, the verb to pick. Maybe it's a vase.
Tight.
Maybe it's like to stare. All those things that maybe don't come up in your food unit, in your actual textbook, your Chinese textbook, or your travel unit Chinese textbook, or maybe like something more koyu, like things you see on the street. So I think where I was at the time, because I was already learning so much in the classroom, I just wanted the kids' book. But I definitely think it depends on what you're looking for specifically.
Yeah, I think you're right, because ultimately it comes down to that motivation. Because you cited, hey, it took me 45 minutes to read one page, right, when you jumped to some of those other books, right?
Yes,
most people give up. And that's the truth of the thing, is most people give up. And so we say, get something a little easier, you know, hey, graded readers, good stuff, haha. But if you're motivated and you really want to do it, then do it.
Yeah, I think all of those things work. There are kids' books, there are textbooks, there are more difficult books, there are graded readers. You know, I'm a firm believer in graded readers. You know, I'm still on the front page of the website for the Mandarin Companion, at least one of the books. And I think, you know, it's about the repetition. You know, I talked to John about this too when I interned with him for one summer at All Set Learning. That repetition is really important, because then you don't have to spend that long on one page, which is, you know, there's a science behind it. As I'm talking about, I remember how much it really just, it was just fascinating, because you could go to a bookstore. The idea that I could get a book for 20 kwai for less than $2, and it would teach me so many things in terms of Chinese language, because it became a thing when I used to go to my friends to larger bookstores. You just look around, browse at titles, you know, what's the topic? And yeah, I think it's a great trade-off. It's a very cost-efficient trade-off too.
Totally agree. And that's fantastic. Well, how many books have you read in Chinese, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I stopped. Once I was out of China specifically, it was really difficult to keep it up after a while. But there are like two kids' books. There's a book about insects that I read, which classifies as a kids' book. Pingfan de Shijie has three parts, and I still to this day have not finished the third part. I started reading San Ti, like the three body problem.
Oh yeah. Great
that
book, by the way.
Yeah. A great book, but it gave me a huge headache. I had to put it down for a second because I was like, wow, it's been so long.
Yeah, I read that in English, and it's still like, I'm like, oh, there was a lot of concepts you're trying to like comprehend. It was, it was a cool book, right?
Yeah, and you're like, wait, did I read that right? Because I don't know if these words are right.
So you have these cool experiences going doing the study abroad thing, but Chinese is a big part of your life now, and also your jobs and stuff are related to Chinese. What do you think is kind of more captivating you and keeping you focused and interested in making Chinese a part of your life?
I think truly it goes back to language. Maybe it's the philosophy major in me, or maybe it's the idea of dialogue when you're learning Chinese. Of it's really about connecting with people and trying to express your opinions about topics people may not be able to understand. You have Chinese teacher are really known for being extremely enthusiastic, extremely caring. So that's really started it. And I don't want to lose that, because there's something about being able to say exactly what you want to say off the cuff. And that's why I think that functionality comes in and proficiency comes in. I think now my focus with Chinese is changed a little more towards a professional sense in terms of international relations, geopolitics. I mean, there's Taiwan and China, because I know my experience in Taiwan was different than China. And that kind of opened my eyes. You have other things about, you know, trade war. You have over-politicization of COVID, but you also have like this wolf war concept in Beijing. I think there are a lot of topics there. And now it's just really trying to understand what this means, because by no way am I an expert, but just trying to understand what these Chinese concepts mean in the Chinese sphere, how different people live in different spaces when you think about Hong Kong, Taiwan, and China. And yeah, I'm just trying to become, a more aware person of the geopolitical movements, because it's capturing the world right now. And I think the biggest thing is that when I was learning Chinese, there was this idea about like cooperation and learning. And it feels like that has moved from partnership to your competitor. And I think just trying to understand how we got here, where it's going, is something that I want to do on the intellectual side, since it's going to have like repercussions, in the world.
How important do you think the Chinese language will be in the future?
I think things move in trends. I don't think people learn Chinese is a trend or was a trend, but I think that there was a time, at least when I was in school, where the two languages that everyone wanted to learn because it was difficult or interesting was Chinese or Arabic. That's just my perception of it. I would honestly have to ask the younger generation, like, do you want to learn Chinese? Why or why not? Because I think that the news is important. How people view China, how people view the U.S. also is really important, because whether you learn a language because you want to engage with a certain type of people or the people you want to be able to engage with otherwise. So I wish I had a better answer, but I think that's a question for the younger generation, even though I'm only 20 something.
Yeah. I'm like, say, you are the younger generation of mine.
Yeah. Yeah. I just feel a shift from when I was learning Chinese, but I haven't been in the Chinese classroom in China for a while. So I don't know if that's changing at all in the country. I don't know if that's changing in the U.S. Because although I was teaching Chinese in high school level, I think at the college level, people have different opinions and intellectual maturity. So yeah, it's a great question. I think people are going to continue to learn it, because I think at the very least, it may be helpful for a job in the future. Maybe it's a challenging language, like, oh, I want to challenge myself. That's definitely a thing. Or maybe, oh, it's something new. No one in my family knows about China or Chinese. Let me learn it so I can learn a little more.
So what are some of the biggest rewards that you've experienced from learning Chinese?
Chinese is the only other language that I've learned to speak proficiently. And there's something about speaking in a different language that kind of changes your soul. I know it sounds like a lot, but the words you're using come from a different like set, from a different world, from a different place, and they have its own life. Again, the philosophy major in me. So as you talk to people, you're drawing from a different set of cultural experiences. And I know that's true. When I hear certain words in Chinese, I can remember the exact space where I learned that word first, or the exact situation, or the exact place in the book. And then, yeah, so I think that just speaking a different language, you're code switching in a way. You're switching between two cultures. And that's why there's some conflicts when you're trying to translate something or trying to get certain concepts out. And I think another thing is just my host mom. I mean, my host mom, when I was in Dalian for the critical language scholarship, it was just me and her. And we would talk about anything at the dinner table. I would wake up and watch the news. I would ask her questions about the news, which, sometimes maybe not what you should do in the classroom. But she was always open to it. She's like, as long as it's a conversation, as long as we're still friends at the end of the day, I'm definitely happy to talk to you. And, I was having every meal with her at night, just me and her talking over a lot of good food. And you learn so much from connecting with someone. When I left the program, I didn't realize how much I gained from her. So I think those are the two things, my host mom and Dalian, but also just that experience of speaking a different language and accessing a different part of you.
Imani, if you could go back and you could do anything differently, what would you do differently?
I think I would just, you know, get out of the books. I think when I was in Beijing during my gap year and when I was in Dalian during the intensive language learning experience, I was really focused on the grade sometimes, just because I just really wanted to be able to say the right thing. Remember, I would be going to bed. I'd be like, oh, how do you say this? Oh, I don't know how to say this. Let me look it up on the dictionary. Oh, well, let me just try to explain the word around. So I was just like thinking a lot. I mean, that happens in English too. You know, my brain's always going. But I think that I would just take a moment and just close the textbook, which I definitely did do, but just, you know, talk with even more people, do more things. I know when I was in Beijing, I was, you know, I joined the Taekwondo club, as I said, and I, you know, sometimes went to a dancing club just to meet new people. But I feel like on the back of my mind, I was like, okay, how can I learn more? But sometimes it's not about that grade. It's not about saying things correctly. It's just about trying new experiences and just putting the phone down, putting the book down. Stop taking notes. Stop taking notes. That was my thing. I would take notes all the time. At the end of my gap year, I would take notes of what my Chinese teacher would say in class, just off the cuff. I'm like, oh, that's how you say it. And at the end of my gap year, I had this book that I made of all the notes I took throughout the year. I had it printed in this local Chinese shop and I compiled it into my own book. And I think that at a certain time though, I just need to step away from taking notes. But yeah, so I would just stop taking notes and just do that. That would be my advice to myself. There's a balance.
That reminds me of, like, you know, here in America, or, you know, we have the 4th of July and you always want to take the pictures of the fireworks. You know,
yeah.
But it's never as good as the actual fireworks. Just put down your phone. You're never going to look at those anyway, right? Just enjoy it as it is, right?
Yeah.
Well, Imani, hey, thanks for being on the podcast here and sharing this experience with us.
Thank you for having me too.
You have been listening to the You Can Learn Chinese podcast. Help us spread the word by sharing this with your friends, classmates, teachers, cousins, swimmer, presenter, sleeper, realtor, dancer, driver, foodie, philosopher, and that one guy named Stan. You can subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And please write us a review so we know how we're doing. You can find us on Facebook and at mandarincompanion.com. Apologies to John Cena, we just ran out of time. The You Can Learn Chinese podcast is produced by myself, Jared Turner, and our editor is Kaiser Guo at SubChina. And interview editor is James Harper with Filter Productions. I'd like to thank our guest, Imani Kaur, and of course, thanks to my co-host, the man, the myth, the legend, John Pasden. See you next time.